I love the card. I love the design of the card. I'm still waiting for somebody to kind of break it.
The Abyssins and Spellquellers in those decks are just amazing.
If there's one thing Matt's good at, it's not magic. It's smoking meat.
The artwork on that card just kind of freaks me out. Reminds me of the Dementors from Harry Potter.
Don't play this deck.
This is going to sound disrespectful, but that's not the way that I intend this to be.
Oh, I can't wait to pull on early to meet.
It's the week after a Pro Tour, and you're spending more time with the tryhards. Still not the best EV you can find for yourself. I'm Sean Seacrest, he's Brian Tibbetts, and he's Matt Hurley. Oh, you brave soul. Welcome to this week's episode of Tryhards. We'll break down everything from Pro Tour Kaladesh. And yes, it's kind of like a Family Guy Meg episode when you know you're going to get more Matt. Use the mute button accordingly. We'll also crown our winner again. It's a head that's already got marks on it. That's all I can give away ahead of time. In the elevator, 3 minutes to brew, what we did to get better at magic, all coming up this week on Tryhards. We get started each week, guys, with what are you drinking? I know the three of us have been very busy lately, but all of us took time to at least watch the top eight from the Pro Tour. I had a beverage in my hand, not the one that I'm having right now, but I hope you all did the same. Brian, get us started. Hopefully you're through the stash of Two-Hearted Ale and have something new to bring to the cast.
I do have something new to bring to the cast. It was actually my 20th college reunion this weekend, so that tells you kind of, you know, what an old guy I really am. So we had a bunch of great friends come in from out of town, and one of the best, Megan Roth, came in from Kansas City. And came over Thursday night, actually, to kind of catch up on some things. And was like, what do you like drinking? I'm like, bring me something hometown. So she brought me some Boulevard, which is always a nice surprise. So Pop-Up Session IPA. Pretty light. It's hoppy, but not too hoppy. It's almost got that kind of summery spritz to it. So, yeah, this was kind of for the warm days settling in here the last couple days, this is quite refreshing, and never say I thought I'd, you know, want an IPA in October, but here we are.
I'm actually drinking a little bit of Cab that we went to a wine tasting on the river, and they had, it was like 45 wineries there. We were there for 4 hours, and we didn't have time to taste all of the wine, and we didn't use up all our tickets, but I did pick up a bottle when I was down there of a Cabernet I really liked from California, and they also gave us like a little commemorative of glass, but I'm drinking just a little bit last of that, so changed it up a little bit tonight.
You changed it up, and I am reaping one of the rewards for my part-time job with the group of stations that I'm with. Our chief engineer travels to the other properties that the parent company owns, and he is a collector of Bruinia, so he likes cans and bottles and unique things like that. But he doesn't like beer, so it falls to another coworker of mine and I to do him the favor of drinking the beer out of the cans and bottles that he brings back, and then returning the empty ones for his collections. And I have something I've never had before, Iron Horse Brewery from Ellensburg, Washington, the Hopped and Loaded Finger Gun IPA. This has been very hoppy, not bitter hoppy, but just a strong taste of hops and a nice dry finish. So I think it's a pretty much a traditional IPA in that way. But the Finger Gun, I'm only a couple drinks into it.
The Finger Gun, what a great name.
Finger Gun IPA. It's just the top of a skull and then two hands, yes, with flesh on them, making the finger guns. So that's what we're drinking tonight here in the studio as we do this one this evening. Guys, what magic did you play? We all watched a lot of the Pro Tour this weekend, but did either one of you get out to play, Matt?
Another draft on Thursday night. I ran down there to sell some cards, and it was an average draft. Went with a black-white deck. Actually got cut a little bit out black. Ended up losing in the second round, so I didn't win anything. That was the last of my free drafts. When I went down there to sell, I actually got more out of my cards than I expected. They utilize Star City's buy list. So I took some cards down there that Star City was within about 10% or so of. I convinced them, we were talking back and forth on price, convinced them to give me another free draft. So I've paid for one draft down at the local shop. And I've drafted, I think now, 4 or 5 times.
All right, congratulations. You've been getting to draft regularly, something yes. I've been missing out on. I had many things taking away my attention this weekend, at least as far as when the LGS was having events. So I once again bring nothing to the table on the what magic did you play this week. Brian, are you going to turn out your pockets and stand here like an orphan with me, or did you actually get in some magic?
Boy, would I love to say that I got in some magic, but I am going to be the orphan. Please, sir, may I have some more? It's just not happening right now. So looks like I'm going to have one more weekend next weekend with the dearth of magic, and then I will be back on the horse riding that pony as hard as I possibly can. So, yeah, sorry. I'm with you. I bring nothing.
Sean, I got a question for you and Tibbetts. Did either of your stores do anything special for the Pro Tour?
I will tell you that my LGS here in Quincy, Illinois, did not. There was not even a magic event other than Friday Night Magic. I asked about that specifically when I was there looking for some cards last week because I had a window from about noon to 4 on Saturday that I would have been able to do something at, and they're just getting ramped up for game day coming up this Saturday.
No, mine didn't do anything specifically for the Pro Tour, but they did have a two-headed giant on Saturday that I heard was a ton of fun. And then I think they followed that up later on with a draft later that night just because everybody stuck around and that's kind of how those things work. So they fire quite a lot of events, but I don't think they have the TV there and, you know, kind of watch it. I'm sure everybody was on their phones checking in on stuff.
The reason I ask is due to that wine tasting, I was unable to attend, but the local store had a kind of a viewing party and they had 4 or 5 small tournaments throughout the day. They're trying to solidify a weekend schedule. And so they're just kind of throwing random tournaments out there and seeing what sticks. They don't have a lot of people actually show up on Saturdays and Sundays, and they want to change that, which I think is great. It'd be nice to, you know, have a regular legacy on Saturday or Sunday. But he provided free pizza, and from the pictures I saw, they had about 20 or 30 people show up. They had a bunch of big screens all over the room. They have 5 or 6, I think, and they had the Pro Tour playing on all of them. So even though with the time change, I think that's a great idea, and I really like that. I just didn't know if other LGSs were doing it or not.
There wasn't anything in Quincy about that, but one of the best stores that I've seen for that is Titan Games, specifically their Springfield, Illinois location. A couple weeks ago, I was traveling on a Sunday from Bloomington Normal back to Quincy, and it takes me right by the game store in Springfield. So I stopped, looked for a couple of things. I think I sent you guys a pic of some of the things I picked up, and they were having another carry-in. This is like the third time I've seen that. And I don't know if it's every Sunday, but they seem to have special events lined up where they do a gamer carry-in, sort of a potluck with people bringing food and so forth. And it looked like a very tight-knit community. A lot of people were showing up within 5-10 minutes of the LGS opening its doors. They had a table up front. People weren't just playing Magic. People were getting into board games and doing a lot of different things. And that's something that I wish we could emulate more of here with my LGS.
Yeah, they were actually bringing in food and stuff there. I didn't know they did that there.
Yeah, that's exactly what I saw. People were bringing in homemade dishes and things like that.
Huh. I'll have to suggest that because they've been looking for kind of a a hook to get people to come in on the weekend. So I'll have to talk to the guy and tell him that maybe that's something they should look at.
Maybe for a couple more free drafts, you could do your delicious Hurley's smoked meats. If there's one thing Matt's good at, it's not magic. It's smoking meat.
I actually don't have my smoker anymore. I sold it since there's no open flames within 50 feet of any building or any residence within Louisville area.
Oh, so restrictive, so restrictive.
I know. I need to get when we sell the house, my first purchase is going to be electric smokers because you're allowed to have the electric smoker.
Already,
man, I don't know. We might not be able to come visit anymore. Sean, I was planning on coming to visit, but that seems weird.
If we're not going to get a side of smoked brisket in the dead of winter in Louisville, I don't think it's worth making the trip. So we might have to reconsider that. Or, Brian, we could just stay somewhere else.
How would that be? Early, we show up in Louisville and see you for, like, coffee on Sunday afternoon. That'd be about it.
I've, you know, there's a dumpster right outside you guys can stay in, too. You're more than welcome to stay there.
That is a Legacy GP coming up in Louisville right after the turn of the calendar to 2017. The tryhards planning on being there together. More on that as we get closer to it. Pro Tour Kaladesh was this past weekend. I got to watch quite a bit, mostly on delayed coverage overnight, of the drafting. And this is something I've talked about before on the show. I've been trying to dedicate myself this year to getting better at limited in all forms, but mostly drafting, because it's mostly what I get the opportunity to do. And just to think along with the different pros that they had cameras on, it was, I thought, an invaluable experience for me. And then standard, always so interesting with the new format. And we're just going to start with broad brushstrokes here, guys. My favorite thing about this pro tour was that it disproved the notion that you can't play control early in a format's development. We had control on control in the finals, that's true, but you also had several other successful control lists along the way. Now, I don't know if that's just a byproduct of the way Kaladesh was designed, but it certainly seemed like a format that was hostile to control after the vehicle explosion of pre-release weekend and then opening weekend with red-white vehicles being the level one deck. It seemed hostile to control, but it turned out that control was functional, and it was fun to see something different than all-out aggro, Brian.
It was so great, and it just kind of appeased my soul a little bit to see people casting Void Shatter, to see people casting Negate, to see Torrential Gear Hulks flashing those things back. Oh my gosh, it was just so fun. And yeah, you're absolutely right. I think coming out of it, everybody thought that aggro was going to be it. Looking at the results, however, mid-range decks did really, really well. Some vehicle decks did well as also, but I love the fact that control has a place in the metagame this early on.
Ian Duke actually specifically mentioned control, and they did say they wanted to rectify kind of control being bad for, how long has it been since we had a good control deck? 3 years?
When was Sphinx's Revelation in Standard?
That was Return to Ravnica block, so 3 years ago for sure.
It's been a while, but Ian Duke specifically mentioned that. He said that, and then he said that's why we pushed Torrential Gearhawk.
Now, this is a point I thought we'd get to later in the show when we were talking about Show to the Winner's Deck, and we'll give him his full due in a moment. But I must have seen that same interview, or at least a playback of it, Matt, because it was very interesting to me how Wizards is now specifically purpose-designing finishers for control decks. They've taken player feedback, and player feedback is that they don't want the game to linger on. When they can't win, just get the game over, and they said that was one of the main reasons that they pushed Torrential Gearhulk so hard, was with the 5 power, 4 swings, and the game's over. It closes out a game that an opponent can't win, but that maybe control in the past has lacked that finisher to actually get the game over with.
I think there's a couple other hidden gems in here, too, that are pegged as control finishers. The whale that bounces everything back to their hands.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's a very interesting finisher right there. It was an eye-opening experience to hear him openly talk about that and say, look, we understand control is an important part, because I always feel like they've crapped on control and they want people to, you know, be on the ground with creatures, but they've taken a step forward of integrating that with control so that they can have their new world order along with a good control deck.
Shota Yasoka, the champion, he had all eyes on him. Dare I say he was the Sam Black of this tournament, because Sam Black actually wasn't a great pick. I know, because he was on my roster. We'll get to that in just a moment. But Shota wins it with Grixis. Rich Hagan calling him Showtime. I just bought into it. I was lapping that up the whole way. I found myself rooting for him. Not only is he playing a color combination and a style of Magic that I absolutely love, but to see the innovation, to see him take it Grixis when my initial attempt at this has been Esper, was very interesting to me, and I learned a few things along the way. And the first thing I want to ask you guys about is, I'll start with you, Brian. If there's another deck besides Shota's that impressed you, bring it up, and then give me your impression of how Energy played out overall from this tournament. Because I was very down on Energy when it was announced by Wizards as just another resource you have to track in the game. And, oh, there's no way to attack your opponent's Energy, so is this going to be too powerful? I thought it was flavorful. I thought it was valuable. But I didn't think it ever got overwhelming throughout the weekend.
No, I think that the energy mechanic is just so spot on. And you could hear from R&D side throughout the weekend when they did that coverage that it was one of those things they really, really did try to kind of nail, even from Morrow's original thing. Because he said back on did it was Mirrodin, I should say. He really wanted to find out what's powering artifacts. So that was great. The deck that I really thought, and I was hoping it would make a much better showing in the top eight, and it really didn't, was Pierre Dagen's Blue-Red Spells, the one that uses Dynavolt Tower. It's got a Torrential Gearhulk, another one on the side, but for the most part, this is just grips full of instants and sorceries to just take advantage of building up the energy and then just, you know, popping Dynavolt Tower whenever you can. So I really like that deck a lot. I think that's going to be a popular choice at FNMs going forward because it's not that expensive to build. Obviously, you've got the Gearhulks in there, but every other card in there, you know, it's not that expensive. It really isn't. It's not using a bunch of the Verdurous Gearhulks. It's not using any of the Smuggler's Copters. So I really like that deck. I think it's got more room to build. I think we've got some Bedlam Reveler room in there to kind of make it more of a ground mid-rangey game if we really want to.
Ooh, Bedlam Reveler has been called.
Yes, Bedlam Reveler has been called. I am definitely still on blue-red, and I love that card in this current energy game where everybody just wants to get energy and you're popping instants and sorceries. I think Bedlam Revelers are going to hit your local gaming store soon, so be on the watch out for that 3-4 prowess.
Hurley, what'd you think about energy and a favorite deck?
I actually think that energy, again, is a really, really good mechanic after seeing it. I agree with what you guys said. I think we still have to look forward to what energy cards are coming in Aether Revolt, and it's very possible that they might make this part of the wider multiverse. Because if they say, oh yeah, you know, Aether is what runs all these artifacts, anything that has any sort of artifact theme could essentially have energy in it. Again, my worry is that they print something in Aether Revolt that's a little too over the top, a little too powerful. And if that happens, you know, maybe a too good of a mana sink, then energy could easily be broken. But overall, energy played a much bigger role than I thought it would, but that's not a bad thing. One of my favorite decks actually was the Grixis Control. I think that just looked amazing. Blown away by what cards they chose in there. The 3-drop that produces energy. It produces 3 energy and then does damage equal to the amount of energy you spend.
Harness Lightning.
Yes, Harness Lightning. That was doing work all weekend. And I think the black blue is a base for something, and maybe the other colors, you know, maybe it's Esper, maybe it's Grixis. I'm not sure what the best control deck is, but there's a good control deck out there.
Yeah, going forward, I'm going to stay right where I am right now, and that's with the Esper development. I was a little worried when I started looking at control decks for this format that red was going to be too weak, but Harnessed Lightning was very, very impressive to me. And you pair that with Radiant Flames, which is still in the format, and the Demise of Languish, I guess, was overhyped in that, well, maybe Grixis might not have a sweeper that could control the board. It did, and boy, did it work, as most of the other decks, sans Torrential Gearhulks, were able to be mopped up by that Radiant Flame. So I think there is something there. The card that was popping off the table in my mind because of its dearth of inclusion in 2 successful control decks that had red in the finals. We didn't even tip our hat yes to Carlos Romao. He has been on an absolute heater. Won a GP, just came in as a finalist at Pro Tour Kaladesh. He went Jeskai control. Guys, neither one of these 2 control players included Chandra, Torch of Defiance. This card was all the rage coming out of spoiler season, and Matt, we didn't really see this have an impact anywhere.
Everyone talked about how it's really bad against vehicles. It can't kill the vehicles. Sweepers aren't that good right now because of vehicles. I'm thinking maybe combination of energy and vehicles might have been a little bit too much, that they made them too good, but I'm shocked that it's seen such little play, but it'll get there eventually.
All right, that's what was impressing me as we came out of Pro Tour Kaladesh. It'll be interesting to see which control deck gets adopted by the wider community. Will it be Grixis? Will it be Jeskai? Will it be Esper? I happen to feel like right now, Esper has the tools to fight aggressive decks as well as the tools to fight against other control decks in the inevitable mirrors. The inclusion of Avacyn, it to me, is the big one. To have that big of a threat at Flash where you can pressure another control deck, Brian. I know looking for those breakers, those trumps, those aces in the control mirror, always a big part of it.
Always a big part of it, and it was really kind of fun to see the chess match between the control decks. One side would have Avacyn, the other side would have the Torrential Gear Hulk, and they could almost sense that the other person had it. So, you know, who's going to flinch first? What's the best sequencing on this? But yes, those are the two finishers in the control decks. The other thing I'd love to hear your thoughts on is relating to the energy discussion was the Teemer Aetherworks deck, that seemed to do some really, really good work. Didn't quite make it, but I have often thought that that card was going to kind of have its day, and it really had its coming out party. Maybe playing second fiddle a little bit to Torrential Gear Hulk. That can do some broken things on turn four. So where do you think that card sits and that deck sits in the metagame going forward?
You know, I heard a lot of bad talk about that deck. Not that it wasn't good, but it was very unpredictable. A lot of players did not like how essentially it was an uncounterable spell. I mean, you had to counter the Marvel itself, but once that was on the table, it was essentially an uncounterable look at your top six, put a creature card into play. And a lot of people did not like that. I think it's cute. I think it's a fun FNM or small tournament, maybe even a GP deck. But there's a lot of bad matchups, and Negate just eats it for lunch. So as long as Negate's around, I think it'll be kept in check.
Yeah, I agree with Matt. Negate is the big killer for this deck. It's such an efficient answer to what they're trying to do. And most of the deck is dig. And if you draw a couple of times, we saw Matt Nass, Basketball Shorts himself, was playing this over the weekend. And he would end up with a couple of his big Eldrazi in hand. He was only playing seven. I think he whiffed twice back-to-back in a match that I was watching.
Oh, yeah, he did. He did, totally.
It's that inconsistency that I think would scare people off the deck in shorter tournaments. I'm actually on the opposite side of the coin from Matt with this one. I think if you're looking for something powerful that you can run hot and take down a GP with, this is it. Because what you're saying is, I'm going to run hot and I'm going to do this, and this is the fastest combo deck in the format versus, you know what, if it's a smaller room, I could probably just play my edges with something else. But if you're looking to go full-in combo, you know, and I've played Belcher in Legacy. This isn't quite that, but it could be that on the standard level, because if you hit, you're likely to win, but if you whiff, now you got to reload and it's always too late.
Agreed, and it's interesting, too, that card plays really, really well with big things, or, you know, all kinds of big effects, so people are putting Descend Upon the Sinful in those decks, because hitting that at the right time could be backbreaking for the opponent. We've also got to remember that Nahiri is still part of the metagame, not seeing a whole lot of play. But when you're trying to put big things in, now we've got kind of this two-pronged attack. We can go the Aetherworks Marvel. We can go Nahiri, who does card advantage while she's just on the board sitting there, you know, trying to reach that ultimate. So I think there's something there. I love the card. I love the design of the card. I'm still waiting for somebody to kind of break it and maybe catch on those coattails and ride it. But yeah, I'm with you, Sean. I think a GP might be a good place for it to really shine. And I'm looking forward to playing it or against it in the next month or so and see maybe what I can come up with.
I know Matt's got a big breakdown that he's going to get to in a moment here about decks from Standard over the PT weekend versus results from Limited. But before we get there, guys, were there any top cards that were breakout cards to you? I was just kind of making a list from before the show, and we've covered a couple of these. I had Torrential Gear Hulk, Aetherworks Marvel, who we just talked about, Smuggler's Copter, which has gotten plenty of press already, and Dynavote Tower was kind of popping around there for a while. He didn't end up making any big noise in the top eight, but Dynavolt Tower, I think there might be something there that it just takes working out the rest of the list.
Anything that generates energy, the Attune with Aether card, which to me was kind of a limited bomb. I was very happy to have two of those in my sealed pool a few weeks ago. You know, go kind of ramp up and get some energy while you're going. I just think that card fits in so many formats. You know, the red-green energy decks, it fits in the Aetherworks deck. The Nibelus of Frost was around a lot, mostly sideboard card, obviously. But the artwork on that card just kind of freaks me out. Reminds me of the Dementors from Harry Potter. But still a really, really nice sideboard inclusion. So, yeah, I think we hit on the major ones. There's just so many good decks that have synergy with a lot of the other things that are out there that you really have to look deck specific. And that's the fun thing about brewing nowadays. Go pull some of those cards that you didn't think were going to be worth anything, playability wise in a deck. And you're going to be pleasantly surprised, I think, in the current standard metagame.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting, especially when we saw how the level one deck played out. And what level one is a reference to is the best known deck heading into a big tournament. And that was Red-White Vehicles coming into the Pro Tour. And it had some success on the SCG circuit. Red-White Vehicles was the level one deck. It was aggressive. It used the powerful cards. It had, if not library manipulation, then card selection that allowed it to keep the pressure on. Many were projecting that none would make it. Two level one Red-White Vehicles decks made the top eight. And guys, I think this is a reminder. Magic players, especially Magic players who have been around for a while or tend to like to play control like we do, will sometimes get too cute and outthink themselves. Not every level one deck is good enough, but sometimes those level one decks are just that good. And I think that's what we're seeing, whether or not it adopts a little bit of black to get an edge on the mirror with Unlicensed Disintegration, whether it stays red-white. I think this Red-White Vehicles deck is going to continue to be the sort of level one, can your deck beat this going forward, Matt?
I would agree. I guess my concern with that would be that it's going to kind of get pushed out by mid-range. We'll talk about that in a second here, but I really like the vehicle deck. I think they need to have something that just deals with vehicles a lot better than what is currently happening. There's something out there that's kind of missing for the control deck so that they're not having to use sweepers at bad times and they're not having to use, I guess, these suboptimal cards at some point. So I would say right now, I would more consider that kind of the level zero deck. I mean, I don't know how you want to rate that, but I'd say the best card, the best deck in the format right now, and it's going to be a monster, is the blue-white mid-range deck. I don't think that control is going to be able to keep up with that too well. This blue-white deck is just a house. It runs Spell Quellers. I think Spell Queller was the breakout card of this format. You just didn't see it because what happened was the guys who were up in the top tables had a really good limited record, and their standard record was okay. All of the decks that went, what was it, Sean? 9-0, 8-1?
Yeah, the article that was put together by Wizards, 24 to 27 point standard decks, were decks that did just that, that finished with at least 27 points, being 9-1 in standard, all the way down to the 8-0-2s and the 8-2s, which would be 24 points. So they have an article, and there's only 24 lists, so it's not that overwhelming. Blue-white mid-range, blue-white flash, blue-white mid-range, blue-white mid-range, those were the decks that finished with 9 wins. There were only 4 decks. They were all blue-white mid-range.
I guess for my job, one of the nice parts about my job, and this is actually a bad part, is that my Mondays are really, really busy, so typically I work from home. Today, I had streamers from 6 a.m. this morning up until probably 6 p.m. I had streamers in the background on my computer playing while I was working, and a lot of guys were playing these blue-white decks. The Avacyns and Spell Quellers in those decks are just amazing. If there's a card that's a breakout card, I would say it's absolutely Spell Queller, but that's going to be a house. I think that's going to firmly take the lead in your level one decks, and it has no problems with the vehicle decks unless you get a bad draw. I mean, I'd say they're 50-50 against the vehicle decks. I'd say watch out for that. Brian, I agree with you. You mentioned Nibelus of Frost. I forgot that that card existed when I was working on this Esper control list.
Right.
I was seeing it do some work, and I'm like, holy crap, I need to put some of those in this deck. Even though it's not a non-creature-centric deck, I think I want to take it in that direction just because Torrential Gearhulk is just too good not to play.
I was wondering where the other Verderous Gearhulks were over the weekend because we have to re-rank them, right? So I think everybody agrees that it's either blue or green Gearhulk number one, depending on how you see the game, number two follows up. I would make an argument after what I saw the Black Gear Hulk Noxious do in Limited that it might sneak in at number two. And then it's like, which one's the worst, the white one or the red one on the bottom? Which is really unusual because Wizards tends to really like white. So usually you assume that would be one of the better ones. But I wonder, I mean, should we just do this really quickly, informally? I mean, for my money, after that Pro Tour, I'm probably going to go from best to worst, blue, green, black, red, white. I still think Cataclysmic, the white one, is the worst because it lets your opponent make the decision, and it could be an even less impactful decision than the Red Gear Hulk.
I would agree with you there. Blue, green, black, red, white. I think that's kind of the where we are right now. Green and black, depending on what you're playing, that could be the spot that switches to me, because Noxious, I think, has only got room to go up. Verdurous, everybody knows, an 8-8 Trampler is just ridiculous. That's where, you know, I might fudge a little bit, but I think red and white are clearly at the bottom and blue's clearly at the top.
Matt?
I would say mine would go blue, black, green, red, white. Yeah. I think that people just aren't playing black right now. The Black Gearhawk, but in that Esper control list we're looking at, there's not that many instants, and I'm wondering if the Black Gearhawk's not better than the Blue Gearhawk in that deck. This says a lot about the design of these cards, that we're having an argument about which the three are the top, and we obviously have them all in the top three. This is the kind of the Titan cycle all over. I mean, you had the same thing, you know, between, I think it was all five of the Titans, wasn't it? Was there a Titan that wasn't played?
Boy, I can't think of it. I think Sun Titan was actually the least played one,
yeah.
And it was intrinsic to the Solar Flare deck. So
yeah, the Solar Flare deck. I was just thinking that because I played that deck too, and I was like, well, yeah, that got play, but you know, maybe blue is maybe the least played. The Blue Titan
Frost, yeah,
yeah. I would say that's the least probably played Titan, but it still saw play in standard decks. I don't know if they would. I would call it tier one. We've got the kind of the Titan cycle all over again, and maybe how they're going to change places over time as everything shifts around and people adjust.
Yeah, Ian Duke mentioned this in one of the times he was talking about development, is that they enjoy doing these cycles of definitive creatures. We've seen them before, the Titans, the Praetors. We've seen these sort of definitive creature cycles, one for each color before, and the Gearhulks were the way they did it this time. And you're right, guys. I think the fact that we're talking about, well, which of these is the best, tells you they were really well designed and do their thing very well in each setting. Matt, I know you've got a further breakdown on the standard lists that finished with either 8 or 9 wins along the way. Get into that and then get into what you were bringing up in the pre-show about it being so dependent upon a limited record to carry you into the top 8. I like that. I like the fact that there are 2 rounds a draft at a Pro Tour, and it's not just about mastering one format or another.
The reason I brought that up is, in one half of my brain's thinking on the financial side of it, the other half of my brain's thinking on the format play of it, and they both are very, very intertwined. If you look at this list, the article that Sean had mentioned earlier, that with 27 points to 25, or I'm sorry, 24 point decks, it's blue, white, blue, white, blue, white, blue, white, red, red, white, Jeskai control, Grixis control, Jeskai, blue, white, black, red, Jeskai, black, green, and then it just kind of tails off from there. The reason I think about this is everyone looks at the final tables and says, okay, so there was a 3 control decks in the final tables, a red, white, and a couple others. Then they go, oh yeah, you know, this is the format, this is what it is. That's not always true. I love at the Pro Tour that it's a multi-format record. You got to combine them so that if you have somebody who's got a really, really strong in one area and is, let's say, good in another, and they're good maybe that in standard they only win 60% of the time instead of 65% of the time. In limited, they might win 75% of the time. So, I mean, we're still talking about top caliber players here. But people just automatically assume those top decks, oh, that's what got them there. Well, maybe standard was their weak area, or maybe they had good matchups. It looks like the Jeskai control and Grixis control were the ones that kind of were the control decks. They took a disproportionate amount of the top tables. So that just means also that the people playing them, we saw this again with the season's past deck. When was that? 2 Pro Tours ago with John Finkel? Anybody but John Finkel picks up that deck and you might as well throw it in the trash because it's just not good. It took some tweaking to get it so that it was good in the general meta. But I just want people to think about that, to say, look, just because somebody won with a Grixis control deck or somebody run with blue-red spells or whatever it may be, does it mean that that's the deck you need to beat? In fact, during the interview, Shota actually mentioned, don't play this deck. He didn't think the deck was, the standard deck was very good. And I think he was serious because he's saying, oh, you know what? I saw the format and I just powered through it. But he's thinking of normal people at GPs and large tournaments are not going to be able to have the success that I did. I just think that just be aware of that. And on the financial side of it, be aware of that as well. Thing in the Ice has not shot up yet, as far as I know. Torrential Gearhulk did because that was the big bomb, but Thing in the Ice, it's kind of still just going up gradually. The other card is the Archangel Avacyn's too, since there wasn't a big blue-white presence up there.
Mm-hmm.
These are currently, I want to say, about $20, and I think this is an easy $30 card if it continues to see the amount of success that I think it will. So just keep this in mind when you look at this. Always look at the coverage for the 24 to 27 point constructed deck list. Look at the records of the other format that the top players are playing so you can get a better idea what the format looks like.
Whenever I scroll through this, I look for two different things. One, the name attached to the deck. If it's a big name, people will look at it and give it some credence. And is the deck doing something that wasn't well represented in the top eight? I'm just going to throw three out. We don't have to go into big detail. Tamaharo Saito, four color vehicles. You get to get greedy with your color base, and you get to play a whole bunch of vehicles in there. The other one that jumps out at me was Ifro's Black Green Delirium list. This is, if you had Black Green Delirium before rotation, you don't have to do a lot of work to put this together, and it was very, very good when I saw it on camera. And the other one, Dijon's red-blue spells, Brian already talked about. So the other one that I'm going to grab as I just scroll down through this real quick was the red-green energy deck. And I can't find the name of the gentleman who played it, but it's a name that you know.
Sean McLaren played it to about a 40th place finish.
That's right. That's who I was thinking of. Yeah. Sean McLaren. That red-green energy deck is aggressive, and it will squeeze your outs because it can finish without getting into the red zone and use some of that energy. So if I was just going to kind of pick three from amongst the non-top eight list, but that had names attached and did something different, those are the ones that kind of jump off the page to me. Brian, did anything like that jump out to you?
I was really interested in the energy decks, kind of those, you know, what do we want to call them, modern ramp or something like that. That seemed to be pretty much, you know, what was holding back from the top eight. That and like Hurley said, the blue-white stuff. Those really are the decks I think that are going to have the most room to move up. Other than that, you guys really touched on all the really good ones. I'm just really, really giddy about this standard metagame in a way that I haven't been in quite a long time, just because I still feel like there is so much room to brew and so much room for people to keep exploring the mechanics and even the vehicles. I don't think we've exhausted vehicles in any way, shape, or form. There's some big vehicles out there. I could see some big vehicle lists coming our way.
Matt, was there anything on the financial side that you wanted to get to before we do In the Elevator later on? Was there anything, kind of an overarching theme or three or four hot things that you saw come out of this Pro Tour? You did actually just walk us through a few. Avacyn, Spell Queller, Thing in the Ice, anything that was off that control path.
The other big one that I think people have to watch out for is Gideon. I mean, this card was just doing some serious work. It was in a lot of these blue-white decks. It was either in sideboard, main deck. I mean, Gideon was just a house. I talked about how Smuggler's Copter actively made a lot of Planeswalkers bad because you had to have instant speed removal to kill it, and it was essentially a unkillable flyer that would get in and kill your Planeswalkers. Well, Gideon kind of fits outside the realm of normal Planeswalkers because a lot of times he lives outside of the normal Planeswalker shell where he has to build up and do a bunch of things. You can either just throw him out and get a 2-2 and then, oh, you know, he got pinged down for three by a smuggler's copter. Oh, darn, I'll make another 2-2. So you, for four mana, you get 2-2-2s, which is great. Or you can plop them down, get an emblem. Or I actually saw a lot of people plus one-ing him this weekend. Did you guys notice that?
Well, for crewing purposes, it was absolutely amazing.
Yes, and they were plus one-ing him, and I saw a lot of Gideons that were like 7-8 because they were plus one-ing him, crewing and doing whatever it was, and he kind of fit in the other side. So Gideon was doing just some serious, serious work, and I think it's that combination of Gideon, Archangel Avacyn, and Spellquellers that were doing some work. The other card that I saw this morning, or I should say today, when the coverage was playing in the background, people were streaming, was Gisela. There was a crap ton of Gisellas running around. That's a card I think everyone should kind of keep their eye on. I mean, it's super cheap. The only bad part is it dies to the red energy spell that does damage. I can never remember the name of
Harness Lightning.
Yep. It dies to Harness Lightning, but of course, what doesn't die to Harness Lightning? This might be an expensive deck once it starts to get rolling, because these aren't being drafted anymore. So these Archangels, Gisellas, all these other cards are not getting pulled out of packs anymore.
Yeah, Gideon is the one that jumps out to what you were just talking about, because all three modes on him are relevant immediately. If you need somebody to crew something, he can do that. If you want to crew a big vehicle, he can do that. If it's later in the game and you want to go wide, he can buff your entire team as well. So suddenly all three knobs on that card are good in just about every circumstance. So it's that versatility, and the sweet spot for Planeswalkers in Standard seems to be at the four casting cost, and he falls right in there. Doesn't have an exorbitant a color fee attached. It's just too white. You seem to be able to make that fairly regularly in red-white vehicles, as well as in the blue-white decks that were using him as well. So I think you're right. I think Gideon's in that sweet spot. Other things from the Pro Tour that are on our mind? Well, crowning our own Pro Tour champion, this guy's going to need a new shelf by the time we roll around to next year. After our picks on last week's show, I thought it was the weakest team that Tibbetts had assembled since the show started, and he won anyway. That's right. His golden touch continues. Caravalo, Segrist, and Larson carrying him to the title. Although I will say, across the board, it was our least impressive pick'em that we've done since starting tryhards, as Brian won it with a total combined score of 522. Hurley was right behind him with Reed Duke, BBD, and that up-and-comer Paul Cheon at 630. And then Nelson, Sam Black, and Yuya, for me, left me at 798. Yuya did his job, I'll say that. Nelson and Black, I was it was a head-scratcher for me to see them not do so well. The competition is just amazingly high at these, and somebody has to finish toward the back of the pack. Unfortunate for Nelson and Black that happened to them. Brian, it's not exactly a Hall of Fame induction, but at this point, I'm thinking you've got a secret to this process.
If I did, I'd totally share it with everybody. I really don't. Some of it's just kind of gut, you know, following what deck lists I like. I will say Carvalho I've been following for quite a little bit, just because I like the way he builds decks. I love the way he drafts, obviously. Who doesn't? But I was kind of thinking, yeah, he's Standard. I don't know. He's going to do fine in the draft portion, but Standard, it's you know, a big crapshoot. So, I got lucky there. He finished 92nd. But when your top finisher is 92nd, your other ones just kind of did enough. So, yeah, I really have no secret. I thought for sure I was going down in flames this time when you've got the likes of Nelson and Yuya and all the rest. But that's one thing. This top eight was somewhat lacking. Obviously not Yasuoka, but somewhat lacking in big names. I mean, we had somebody playing in their very first Pro Tour. We had, you know, the first Greek playing in a Pro Tour. That's top eight. That was pretty amazing to see some of the people that are not household names come up on this. So I don't fault anybody for their picks this weekend by any stretch. I just got lucky on this one, I will say. So at some point, the run's going to end. And man, I really wish we would have bet on something, because I might have a shelf full of beer or something coming my way. But right now, I got a big zero to show for it. So
we'll let you pull Hurley's smoked meat out when we go down to Louisville for that GP.
Oh, I can't wait to pull on Hurley's meat. That's for sure.
All right, guys. One more thing about the PT. We've almost beaten this horse to death, but there's one more thing that I want to touch on. I was a huge fan of the new format in the top eight, where they did the staggered layers based on record. I thought it kept interesting matches going on later in the tournament, and I thought it was a just reward for the one and two seeds for what they had accomplished. I thought it brought drama to the event. I thought it was a lot of fun. Matt, were you on my page, or did you not like the new top eight look?
I liked it a lot. You didn't mention this, but it cut down a lot on the dead time as well. They had the matches all stacked. You had the players had their scheduled times, but I really, really liked it. Towards the end of the tournament, it did not. It definitely cut down on the number of concessions and everything, so it was successful in what they wanted to do there. But overall, big fan.
Yeah, absolutely a big fan. I feel like the coverage is getting tighter and tighter. I never want Rich Hagan to leave the booth. He's just amazing. And those guys have been around long enough that, you know, we expect good things from Marshall and others. But the Willoughby guy, I thought, is holding his own really, really well. I think he's actually kind of coming into his own in the booth and has some really, really good coverage. Just seems very, very steady. I could listen to LSV talk magic all day long. He sees the plays before anybody else does. He knows the angles. Having access to both sides of the table, he should be the guy doing color on every Magic event.
Willoughby has really been blossoming, doing some European coverage for him, so I'm not surprised to see him continue to up his game. I think he is going to be enormously impactful in the long term if he chooses to stick with it. This is going to sound disrespectful, but that's not the way that I intend this to be. I simply mean it as a compliment to LSV. It took me until Saturday to realize Randy Buehler wasn't in the booth.
Oh my gosh, you're absolutely right. And that's true. It was seamless. It was absolutely seamless. We didn't really miss him because they have such strong people.
They still have a couple people that I'm like, what the hell is this person doing here? Overall, I don't want to get into it. Overall, no, I agree that they're starting to stack the team a little bit. I actually listened to another podcast today, and they were talking about coverage. And I'm not going to lie, they were half drunk when they were talking, so the words were flying. They brought up some good points, and they said, you know, they need to stack this team because they're starting to lose people. Mark Rosewater is not exactly a spring chicken. So how much traveling, you know, how much of this is Rosewater going to want to do because, you know, what's he got, maybe 10 years or 5 years before he winds down? I think that Ian Duke would be a good one to fill in on his end of it, but overall, I think that they're increasing the level of talent. They've still had some issues that, Sean, I'm sure you pointed or you could notice them right away, but they had a bunch of hot mics over the weekend, and I'm like, how does that happen? The one little thing they were doing that I kind of liked was as they would transition from piece to piece, they would kind of show a little bit of the setup. So when BDM was walking one of the players over to the deck tech area, they'd walk through, you kind of get to see behind the scenes. He would introduce some people, describe what was going on, and then, you know, they'd say, okay, hey, we're going to throw you into quick makeup here, and then he would go out into the deck tech area. And this whole thing, I think, fosters a better understanding of the players to say, look, it's not just guys throwing webcams out there with some, you know, with some mics and a couple PCs. I mean, you could see all the hard work that went into it by them just kind of going behind the scenes and seeing all the support staff that's required just to have this. So I think that's a good thing. They've cleared up. What was that called when they were doing from the floor last Pro Tour? Remember they did that really crappy shaky cam style with BDM? Did you guys see that?
I think that was just a camera wasn't set correctly, or there might have been a mount problem. I don't think that was intentionally the handheld Blair Witch style of magic reporting.
But they did a lot better job here. I mean, it was
cleaner,
it was crisper, and it's nice to see, hey, here's the feature match area. Now, what are the other players? I wouldn't call them regular players because it's the Pro Tour, but where
peasants.
Are the other players?
What are the peasants doing?
What are the peasants doing? So, they're throwing a lot of that in there. They filled in the dead time a lot better on this Pro Tour than any I've seen before.
Their pre-recorded stuff seemed to be really interesting, and it wasn't too long either. That was something I was kind of afraid of, but it wasn't too long. It was kind of all high interest, and the personalities at Wizards really do drive those kinds of features that they do. Mm-hmm. And I, for the most part, they're all interesting people and they're not afraid to be on camera. You don't get kind of the mousy person who, you know, kind of sits and shies away from the camera. They're very, very willing to talk about their process. And that's fun. That's fun to watch kind of them in action and to reflect on what they've done.
Enormously successful Pro Tour, Pro Tour Kaladesh for Wizards. A follow-up on that, if you enjoyed the drafting portion of it and want to get better yourself, great article I read this week. Channel Fireball has been doing an in-depth overrated, underrated for Kaladesh draft series. That's worth checking out if you're going to be doing some drafting soon. And guys, we were all kind of hot to just mention this. Enter the Battlefield has now become an ongoing series, and they kicked it off with Roanoke. That is, of course, the home of the behemoth in Magic, Star City Games, not only the headquarters for their franchise, but also the home of many of the players that surround them, write for the site, and so on. So Enter the Battlefield, Roanoke, now out as well. Take that in this week. There's no Pro Tour. You don't have anything else to catch up on. Matt's already given us the extended finance version of the Pro Tour, so that means it's time to, well, I've seen Matt run, so we're going to say waddle over to the elevator and jump right in. Matt, you better not have anything of value on you because this is about to be a confiscation coup.
I think this card is going to do some amazing things. I took this card off to the side and I just threw it into the bulk rare section of my mind. But I mean, there was a lot of times we had 10, 12, 15 energy built up. And in these control decks, you're just fighting over these individual creatures or artifacts. That's the other important part. Even if you have a smuggler's copter or something that's just beating you down, you can steal it from them. Confiscation Coup, I think, is going to be a very important sideboard card in control decks going forward.
Confiscation Coup, Hurley's in the elevator pick for this week here on Tryhards. One of the underappreciated benefits of winning the Tryhard Pro Tour Pick'em is you get to pick the card for 3 minutes to brew on that episode. Brian, what do you got? Give us the details before we get started.
I am so lucky that I get to pick this. I just feel so privileged. Just want to say, thank all the little people out there, including you two, who are looking up at my glory.
Nice.
Peasants.
So as we saw the effect of all of the artifacts this weekend, the vehicles, the Aetherworks, Dynavolt Tower, et cetera, got me thinking about this card. Padim, Consul of Innovation, legendary creature, Vedalken Artificer, 1 blue, 3 colorless. He's a 1/4. Artifacts you control have hexproof at the beginning of your upkeep. If you control the artifact with the highest converted mana cost or tied for the highest converted mana cost, draw a card. Guys, what do you think?
This seems interesting to me because what it's asking you to do is to use an artifact-based synergy in order to get the most out of it. Now, if I start building with this off the top of my head, defensive artifacts come to mind first. Things like Deadlock Trap. Using utility artifacts like this, which may be a way to protect your Dynavolt Towers, your Marvels, this may be the way that you keep protecting them. And let's face it, most of the time, unless somebody's playing a dedicated vehicle deck or using Skyship as a way to attack via a control deck, your 4-drop is probably going to be enough to win you the extra card draw that comes with this. So giving all of your artifacts hexproof while having a big enough butt to survive the one card that we've seen a lot of decks turn to for control in Harnessed Lightning, it does 3 natively. Sure, you can get a 4th energy, but now you have to use resources from another card. I like where this is going. At 4, though, boy, I can't help but to wish that this was 2 and a blue for a 3-drop.
After Aether Revolt, it's going to see a lot more play. I like it once we get to the point where you're going to start going wide with artifacts. Now, we're already kind of going wide with artifacts with vehicles, and you've got some Thopters being made. But once there's a deck out there that just starts pumping Thopters out, and then you're using your Foundry Captain or whatever that is, the 2/3 artifact, I think the hexproof's huge on this. But I also like it kind of in the control decks or in the mid-range decks as a card advantage if you're running some type large Gearhawks. Kind of wish it was like a 3-drop of some type. You know, the blue-blue colorless. I like that idea, Sean. Being a 1/4 is not exactly small. I mean, it can block quite a bit of stuff, and it can block that stuff profitably as well. So I think you're going to be seeing this as a card advantage engine in the next set once there's an actual artifact deck.
It's interesting. If you decide to go wide with artifacts, I kind of like this card as kind of like your stalwart, Sean, as you said, defense. This is the card that enables you to play with Kira, PNLR, to play with your servos, to play with your Thopters, to really start generating the things and then maybe pump them up with Council of the Foundry, whatever that guy is that pumps the artifacts. It looks to me like this could have a play. I think it's going to be one of those fun cards to have, obviously, in commander decks and things if you're running an artifact theme. But for the most part, I'm with you. I'm not sure about the 4 for a 1/4 body. That just doesn't seem very efficient right now. What it does if it hits the board and you've got the right board state is going to be pretty effective. But I'm not seeing it as a whole lot of play. It's just a very, very curious card to see if somebody wants to try to break.
Padim, Council of Innovation, our 3 minutes to brew card this week here on TryHards. That takes us up to what we did to get better at Magic this week. I read one of the more interesting articles that I've seen in a while. Paulo Vitor Dama de Rosa put together an article on Channel Fireball specifically called "You Need to Sideboard Better." And he was right. I think he wrote this article just for me. I need the sideboard a lot better. And he went into how he breaks down the construction of his sideboard, whether you're playing an aggressive deck, a combo deck, or a control deck, or a mid-range deck. He breaks down not what specific cards to use, because that's always going to change from format to format, rotation to rotation, but how many slots he reserves to fight certain strategies based on what your strategy you're trying to execute is, and he tells you when to abandon all hope and not even try to sideboard against it if you don't have that much of a shot to have a winning percentage against it after you sideboard with that number of slots. So having him sort of walk me through how he dissects his sideboard when he looks to use it to augment his main deck was a different way to think about sideboarding for me and a more formal way to think about it. So this is something I'm going to be thinking about going forward, how to construct my sideboard to be more effective to implement my overall game plan. Hurley, what about you? What'd you do to get better at Magic this week?
Actually, when we drafted on Thursday, the three of the gentlemen at my table, they were, I would say, above average drafters. We sat down after the draft, I waited, and we looked at picks. There was two gentlemen on my left and one on my right that all four of us were sitting down. So we were actually able to kind of review the draft because we had all mentioned, hey, we want to get better at drafting. I kind of found out, you know, he's like, how come you didn't take this when obviously this color was open? I showed him and he goes, okay, I understand that. But he's like, and then he's explained a couple of corner cases and I'm like, okay. And then I asked him, I said, what about this? Because you knew I had this or you knew I had taken a rare out of here. So why not pull this? It was a very interesting back and forth, especially with people who, you know, I wasn't real familiar with, and I'm not used to their point of view. So it's much different from sitting down with total strangers to do that than it is like you or Tibbetts or somebody like that. It got me thinking a lot more differently about a draft on this format as a whole and how I want to do it and how I want to construct it.
Brian, what'd you do to get better at Magic this week?
Watching Pro Tour coverage and just realizing what I was trying to do was only focus on one side of the board without the coverage. So I was watching some of it muted and try to only look at, you know, only look at like one player's hand and be like, okay, what would I have done here? What would I do here? What would I do here? Putting myself in the shoes of the pro, so to speak, and seeing how that would go. It was kind of a futile effort just because the coverage, you know, bounced back and forth so much. And so I had access to a lot of information, but just trying to explore their play patterns and explore, you know, land drops and explore why to use a counter spell versus playing the Gear Hulk and flashing back something for free. It was just fascinating to me. I felt like I learned a ton just because you're seeing the best players in the world do this on a very regular basis. And of course they're used to playing at this high level and I'm not. It was a lot of fun, a whole lot of fun. So I'm hoping to take some of this stuff back with me. Overall, what it is patience. I just need to be patient. when you have something with flash and you've got the mana open, that doesn't necessarily mean you should play that. And I think that was something that was definitely spelled out in the finals. Many, many times we had both Ramal and Yasuoka who could have played cards when I would have been like, oh my God, why didn't he play that? Why didn't he play that? And then you look two, three turns later and you're like, this is the much better line. So seeing those lines, seeing the patience that they portrayed, very, very good lesson for me this week.
Brian, teaching you patience as we soldier on through this episode of Try Hards. Thank you for joining us, you brave soul. Now we're all just wondering, what will Aether Revolt bring? Well, the good news is we'll have many more Try Hards episodes to figure that out until that Pro Tour happens. For Brian, for Matt, I'm Sean. This has been this week's Try Hards. See you again next week.